Speaking of reliability. Friends talking about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Adam Barrett.
Hey, Adam. You know, you're an individual consultant, right? And I think you've worked with other people on and off through your career, but you also were a manager of a test lab and a maintenance reliability programs, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I built two reliability departments within organizations and, you know, in the product development R&D side.
Did you ever hear that it was your fault when something didn't work in the field?
I think I'd seen facial expressions that kind of implied that.
Okay.
More than people being so blunted. But I think this is what we were talking about when we decided to record this episode, is we were talking about how it's still surprising how there's organizations out there that operate where they believe reliability can be a solo activity, kind of isolated.
We're going to do a design. I actually was in an interview with a large consumer products company for a brand new platform they were building. And the program manager met me for the first interview. And he said, so if we hire you as a reliability engineer, what do you think you'll be doing? And I said, I'd work with the design team, understand the risk, you know, do this and do that, understand the environment, where it's going, and then, you know, help you guys decide on design decisions, vendor decisions, all of those stuff. And he goes, whoa, wait, let me stop you right there. You won't be able to talk to the designers. That's just not going to happen. Really? Okay. Well, this is not a job for me. Good luck with your quest to find somebody. And I stood up and walked out. I said, I don't want to waste your time or everybody else, although I was looking forward to lunch in your cafe because it's supposed to be pretty cool. and I left. If his idea was that they're going to do a design, they're going to hand it to the reliability engineer to go test it and to prove that it's good. Well, it says, well, what if it's not good? Well, that won't happen. Well, then why are you bother? You know, it's back to the circular argument. Then why bother doing the testing if you already know the results? And so I'm like, nope, this is not a place for me. This won't work. Like you said, I think Carl has a story where we do reliability. You know, George sits down the road here. He's on the fourth cubicle on the left, and that he does all the reliability. Right. And I've run into organizations at HP even like that where, Phil did it all. Phil did everything. He did the derating after the electrical design was already set and it was input into the component selection. He did the stress test designs. He did all this stuff. And when Phil left, the reliability program left their products.
Well, it probably doesn't matter. I doubt it was very effective other than filling out the correct, you know, folders and the filing cabinets with the papers needed.
Phil was actually pretty amazing. He actually got a lot done and was a very, very busy person. It could have been way better, right? And I think that's the main point is the difference.
Wait, I'd like to dig into that a little bit. Right? So if Phil was working on his own, I'm sure he was working hard and doing a lot, but how is he having a good impact on the product if design engineers were handing him work and walking away? How could he possibly be having an impact on the design?
Yeah, I think he did have an impact on design, but it was himself in saying, all right, you need to use this capacitor because the derating says this is what it's used for. And he was built into the system where they would create a circuit and they needed a 50 puff capacitor there, and he would say, well, you need it to make sure it's a quarter watt rated one or a half watt rated one, and then they go okay, and then they go buy it. And but he did those calculations rather than electrical engineers doing those calculations. That it was that level of if there was a mechanical piece or a new component coming in, he would test two or three vendors' options and say this is the one we want, but he never shared how he evaluated them. Right, he would do the engineering work on behalf of the rest of the team and say this is the change you need to make. I think he also had some champions in the group that actually got information from him, and then they would go do their thing and make improvements. But when he left, the story from engineer after engineer there was, oh, Phil used to do that. Well, do you do reliability block diagrams? Oh, Phil used to do that. And he'd present it. Nobody knew how he did it. Or did you do halt testing? Oh, yeah, Phil did that. And you guys never attended those or went to him or something? No, he would tell us what to change.
Mm-hmm. You know? Right, right.
So, I mean, and it, the downside was is that this it was a small team and it wasn't a very complicated product, so it was feasible, but not terribly sustainable is probably the right word. Once Phil left, the program left. Whereas a very similar division at HP was Ma Bell. She was actually the Women an Engineer of the Year award years and years ago. Brilliant woman. But she did very, very little, you know, to be blunt. But she taught and educated and cajoled and enabled, and she put together guidelines and manuals and templates. But the engineering team did the reliability work. So when she left, they didn't hire another reliability person because the team knew when they needed to do an accelerated life test, and there were 2-3 people that knew how to design a reliability test, and they would go do it. And it was night and day difference, and it was one of those stark contrasts that I was able to see those two divisions shortly after Phil left and shortly after Ma Bell left, and the two teams were dramatically different. Plus, the results were dramatically different.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, it's interesting. And it just what surprises me is modern day, how many people still think that siloed model works. Or I should say, also people who are aware that it doesn't work well. They know that the modern day, you know, where the reliability engineer is part of the team, but still, through pressure above them, want to do it the traditional way because they're afraid that they can't show value for the reliability engineer, that there's not actual specific things coming off their desk that show an improved design.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, quality or engineers have this problem too, right? It's not, and other types of engineers face this kind of issue is where they're in a supporting role, essentially, to the mechanical, electrical, and software engineers that are putting in the feature sets, right? A part of the primary designing team's role is to make a reliable product. And you've discussed this before, and I think we've talked about it, is that it's something the staff or the senior management teams, and I think maybe Carl's talked about it too, is they are responsible for it. I'm trying to think of the right words here. They're on the hook if it's not reliable, right? They're the ones making the decisions and setting allocations or resources and everything else. But they often delegate it, right? Hey, George, you just take care of reliability. And then they think they have it handled. We got a reliability guy or a reliability team. We're good. But then don't enable that culture that it lets them actually influence designs or get involved with identifying the right risks and enabling the right decisions going through the process. I think that's the gist of this topic, isn't it, Adam, is that it's not something that somebody does over there and it's good. it's what your organization does collectively. And I often phrase it as that reliability occurs at the point of decision. Do I use this vendor or that vendor? Do I use this component or this component? Do I place this component or this product at this point or that point? How big is the flange to hold this amount of mass? What do I know or don't know? All of those decisions that are done on a daily basis in the development team, it's not feasible for even a very large reliability team to be involved in, right? So it's foolish to think that just because you got a reliability engineer, your product's going to be reliable. Unless they're more like Ma Bell and influencing the decision-making of all of those rest of that team.
All right. So what would be the discussion then if you were speaking with somebody who said, yeah, I get that that philosophy is what works best in the long term, but, you know, we just need the manpower right now. We need somebody to come in and make this more reliable. The engineers are too busy.
Yeah.
Is that somebody you just walk away from, or is that is there a connection that you can make for them? Because I find that to be surprisingly a modern day, you know, point that some people are at. And it's kind of interesting. It's that high level pressure mm-hmm. of having a very specific return for a very specific, you know, investment in a resource like a person. And it's really surprising. And then even when you can point to the downfalls of it historically, that it still doesn't drive it.
Well, I tend to want to just reframe that request. You know, if you want me to run this test, I can do that, right? I can roll up my sleeves and go run this operation or do this FMEA or do these tasks or activities. If they're not connected, and we talked about this in the last episode, if they're not really connected to what you need to make decisions about, then there's very little point in doing that. That doesn't get you the objective you're looking for. Yes, you have a lot to do. Yes, there's a lot of risks to be facing here. So what is it you're trying to achieve? I usually reframe it as, what information do you need to make the right decision? Do we have a product or not? Or is this the right vendor or not? Or is there whatever that, why do they think they need a reliability engineer? And then part of it is also just the culture of the organization. If it's just a checklist, or it's just do what the boss says and nothing else, and nobody really cares about their product at all. If they're all really just time to market, well, yeah, you got to walk away. But fortunately, I've had a couple of clients here lately that they came to us with this notion, we need to improve the reliability capability of our organization. I don't want you to come in and do reliability, right? I want you to enable my team to do reliability. And those are the great, I think they get it, right? And I think that's when folks like you and I can be exceedingly effective, is when you have that top level support and they understand that you're there to help create a capability within the organization. You might be the only identifiable reliability person in the group, but your role is to bring up the capability in the rest of the team and align it, which is a whole lot different than sitting in the back corner filling out a parts count prediction.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. It's, it's definitely something. I mean, of course, as consultants, it's nice when you can, you know, pick and choose. And there's certain people I talk with and I'm like, I don't think, you know, I'll tell them I don't think the value will be there, that I'll be able to provide what they need. If they want somebody just in the seat doing work like that, then that's what they should pursue. But the gains are either, you know, very short term if there are any.
Yeah. Well, I actually got an email the other day. How would you respond to this one? He says, I work in the XYZ company and industry, and we got a request to do a reliability prediction using the Telcordia or a Belcor, and they name a couple of options that were available, and we need MTBF. And I'm like, okay. Well, you know how my response would be usually to that.
Right.
Well, I mean,
because you hate both Telcordia and MTBF. That was a double whammy, right?
Yeah, there. And you know, I don't think it's hate, but it verges on that. It's dismay is probably a better word. So, I mean, but if you got a request like that, this is the opening salvo of a conversation that it's a potential client. It might not be, and they said, "Hey, we need a parts count prediction. We need an MTBF number based on that."
What's my response?
Yeah.
My response first is, who's asking for it? So the reason why I ask that is because if they're like, oh, we're doing this for the military and they're requesting this, you know, they're our customer, mm-hmm. then I know there's no point discussing it, right? Because there's somebody on the military side who's filling out some there's a checkbox that has to be done.
Yep.
Then there's, you know, I mean, then it's like, if you have to do it, fine, you know, we can do it. But as long as you know that I don't consider this to be tremendously valuable, but if, you know, something you absolutely have to do, it's not negotiable because of something like a military customer, fine. But then if they're asking for their own knowledge, you know, and I ask, where does it come from? And they're like, oh, so, you know, our VP said we need to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I'll say, well, you know, this is stuff that used to be done in industry, and but there's, you know, been a, there's a lot of, if you look into it now, you'll find a lot of people don't base design or, you know, reliability statement decisions on these like they used to. And, you know, can I speak with him or, you know, and try to guide them on a path to making a better investment,
mm-hmm.
In something else that will yield information that will help them. So,
yeah. And, I mean, there's a, and I agree with you. It's try to figure out where it's coming from and what are they really trying to accomplish? You know, because so many people use MTBF as a surrogate for, they really want reliability information. And they believe that MTBF is the reliability value that they need. And so, and it could come, like you said, from a direct request from a customer that won't accept anything else, and that's a condition of business, right? That's fine. But the hard part is that the person requesting it was their reliability engineer. And he was like, I don't, you know, we don't use this, and I don't know how to do it. So we just need a consultant to whip it up for us and send it over to them, which speaks to a larger issue. Is I've seen organizations where they either know they're way understaffed, or they're bucking the timeline or whatever, so they outsource. I actually saw an organization outsource an FMEA completely. They just sent the bomb and the drawings to this other organization, and a few days later, that other organization sent them a report with an FMEA in it. Complete.
Right.
No discussion right. with the design team, no brainstorming. They didn't understand more than what was in the bomb.
Right.
And I'm like, all right. there's so, one person can go contract out all this stuff. And it's the same with the design process. You can contract out power supply, right? And you'll be lucky if it works for your application. There's a lot of other things that go into creating a design for a particular solution, right? And same with FMEA. And I was like, oh, no, that's not so doing basic, FMEA.
It's such a fundamental misunderstanding of the actual tool and what it does. So, I mean, that's why I usually start with the question of who's asking.
Yeah.
You know, I always want to educate people and have them, you know, get the best return for what, you know, what they are able to invest. So, I mean, so if our discussion starts with, you know, what do? I guess that's the answer, right? You try to help them, you know, get enough knowledge to figure out what they do need.
Mm-hmm.
But if they stand strong on wanting that one thing because that's the checkbox they're supposed to check, then you have to let it be, right? I mean, and then the question is, do you help them do it or not? I mean, it's like being a tailor and having somebody ask for, you know, a lime green crushed velvet suit, you know?
Oh,
and
I like those.
Yeah, exactly. So you're the guy. And then I try to explain to Fred, hey, Fred, if you get that suit made, nobody's going to talk to you. And you're like, nope, that's what I want. So in the end, you make him the suit if that's what he wants. Like, okay. You know, like, so I'll do the Telcordia MTBF prediction for the thing that, you know, won't do it. But, you know, I'll be open about the fact that, you know, this isn't, you're not going to pick up any ladies at the bar with this thing. So
no, you're not going to learn anything useful is the other piece I get out of this.
Yeah.
I actually, you know, thinking of the parts count prediction, I actually had a client that asked me to do some parts count modeling, some block diagram modeling, essentially. But it was comparing three different strategies for their design. And it was one created a little more heat, but used fewer parts. Another one, you know, was more parts and a little less heat. Another one was a cooling solution on those kind of designs. And they were looking at the trade-offs of, if we add more complexity to it, what's the downside versus the benefits we get by running it cooler, for example? Those kinds of questions. And I thought, you know, that might actually be a reasonable use for a parts count. And so we talked about the pros and cons and what we're doing on it with a great big strong caution in paragraph one, do not use this to represent your final field failure, your advertising or anything like that. It has nothing to do with that.
Right.
But in general, so we went with some assumptions that if you kept it simple and cooler, it usually was a better thing. And so we made a bunch of decisions that way. But it in every case that I've seen a reliability program work well, it was not a solo engineer, throw it over the fence kind of operation, right?
I've never seen that work well. I can't imagine how it could. I mean, the only way it possibly could is if your reliability program is for the same type of PCB board your company's been making for the past 50 years, and the reliability engineer at this point knows the design side of it. Yeah. Right. That would be the only way you could hand it to Bob, and Bob makes it, checks that it's going to be reliable, or suggests, like you said, use this capacitor, use that. And it's because they're practically a design engineer just by osmosis at that point. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Or they were a design engineer.
And they moved into reliability. That could be the only possible thing. So it would be a company that doesn't innovate, a company that just makes the same thing over and over again. You could potentially have a reliability engineer sit in a corner and just, you know, do their thing. But I mean, it's obviously not a very exciting company.
No. And, you know, you see it, though, out of the, I want to say, Lockheed-type companies and Boeings and others that have more of the military contract style of work they do. They often then have a big reliability team and they used to have big operations and manufacturing teams. And it's mythology, but it was essentially they threw the design over the wall and the reliability guys got to look at it. And then they threw it over the wall to operations and they all blamed each other. You know, that was not uncommon in the 60s and 70s, right? And yeah. I think some organizations have maintained that structure, and many, many other organizations have moved way away from that to our benefit of having better products all the way around.
Yeah, I think the organizations that have maintained it have fallen by the wayside. I don't think a lot of them can possibly survive in this day and age with lack of tolerance for poor reliability, instant online product rankings, you know, all over the place, and very fast innovation. There's no way you could keep up today. Not no way, but you'd have to have a lot of momentum to still be running at this point and working that way.
That's true. You know, and I think one last note on this is that my experience has been that a lot of reliability engineers are the only reliability engineer in their organization. They're either tapped on the shoulder and says, "Hey, Sue, you're going to be the reliability person now, and that you champion that part," or somebody gets hired into an organization to be the reliability person. That's okay. I think you can be the only one there because the span of influence you have is amazing, right? If you work it that way, if you're more like Ma Bell, where you're enabling other people to do the right things and encouraging them and teaching and coaching and controlling, that you get, now you have the entire organization is part of the reliability program, right? Where I think the downside in contrast is that when you're the only one there, or even if you're in a large team of reliability people, but you don't get to talk to anybody else. you're just doing your thing, write a report and send it off, and it's a checkbox, or it's not useful in a sense. But it's okay to be alone in an organization. It's just not okay to be isolated.
Yeah.
Is that the right way to phrase
it? I think that's a good way to put it, yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, if you're listening to this and you're looking to the left and right and you're going, I'm the only reliability person here, you know, it's maybe just a quick self-check. Are you just a cog in a larger machine and pushing paperwork across and just getting things checked off, or are you actually making a difference? And I sound kind of harsh when I heard myself saying that, but if you're working with the rest of the team to identify risks and to help them make decisions, and you're not alone, right? You're part of the team. And I think that's the difference. You can be the only one, but not solo. So
I agree.
Right. So head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR and let us know what you think. What's your situation and how's it working for you? And if you're looking for a way to change what's going on there, you know, what are your ideas? How do you see getting out of that? How do you, if you're in a solo throw it over the wall kind of organization, what's your plan to get out of that? Love to look over your shoulder with that. And maybe, I'm quite sure then we would bring it back to another episode and talk about it, because it's well worth the effort to build a good, strong culture in your organization around reliability. It's benefit to everybody. So with that, we look forward to hearing from you. Again, it's ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. So with that, Adam, I think I'm going to go back to my desk and be working alone.
Oh, the consultant's life. A consultant reliability engineer. Talk about a double whammy for loneliness.
That's right. That's right. You know, I don't think you're all that alone. Although riding in a motorcycle like a Ducati is probably a lonely event. I don't know. Can you put two people on one of those?
Yes, you can. There are ones you can, but okay. It's usually hard to convince some people to do such a thing.
Yeah.
The one I'm married to will only do it with big cruising bikes, like with heated seats and like an armrest kind of thing. That's how I get to go on one.
Okay. Yep. Yeah, the life you live, I tell you. Mm-hmm. All right, cool. Well, I'm glad you're still around and glad you didn't buy that bike. I would really seriously worry about you then, but more so than I already do. All right, cool. Well, thanks, Adam. And this is a weekend to relax. No use case 7 stuff. So yeah, we'll talk to you later.
All right. Sounds good. Take care.
Cheers. Bye. Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.